The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Boot computer, list of today's guests, signing in chat room, lining up news articles, checking levels, adjusting cam, secure wire connection, restart computer, checking video feed.
With all she's got to do, you'd think Nicole Sandler was a one-woman band. Well, she is, and she's ready for another show. And now, here's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com.
All right. Welcome to a Tuesday, everybody. Oh, hold on. We got no audio. Now we have audio on the YouTube. Wow. Okay, let's start over again. Hi, welcome to the show. It's a Tuesday, and we've got a show for you. So every few weeks, I'm fortunate enough to have Marcy Wheeler come on the show and just sort of download all the knowledge that she has amassed over the last, you know, since the last time she was here. And today is one of those days. Now, Marcy is in Ireland. That's where she's living these days. And so with the time difference, sometimes it's just easier for her to join, you know, to do it earlier in the day. Because now it's, 10, 11 o'clock at night over there. So today's one of the days that we got together early. Plus, part of it today is she is on the call because the special master had his first official meeting with Trump's lawyers and the Justice Department prosecutors to hammer out this deal. So because we taped this before that, today's interview will not cover what went on, but perhaps you were on the call. I understand it was quite chaotic because nobody's phones were muted. I don't know. But what I am hearing is that this special master, Judge Deary, is not what Donald Trump thought he was getting. No, was described as a judge's judge. And you feel like listening to the proceedings today, the rule of law is back in court. So that's a good thing. So I'll tell you what, we're just going to jump right in. Again, it's the magic of videotape. And maybe we'll have a few minutes at the end, but, you know, get ready. A lot of information is coming your way, courtesy of the wonderful Marcy Wheeler. All right, let's try this. Here we go. Well, today we welcome back to the show Marcy Wheeler, who has been watching everything that's going on. And Marcy, it's got to be more difficult with each passing week to keep track of all the moving pieces because there's so much happening.
I made a Trump espionage site so that I can keep track of it. It's now my official brain. People can go look. And so, yeah, I'm having to like write things even more down than I normally do, because you're right. Things are, there's so much going on. There's so many pieces, parts.
So is this a separate site from emptywheel.net or?
No. Oh, it's just a link to a resources where I've got all my posts, but all of the filings in the Trump espionage case. And that's where I keep going back to, because that's where my brain is at this point.
I hear you. Well, I give you all the credit in the world, as do the listeners, when I say that you're coming on. You can feel the excitement building. One thing I want to say before we get into it is that emptywheel.net is not behind any paywall. You do this work and people who read it and absorb it hopefully support your work because you operate the same way that I do, that the Brad blog does, that a bunch of us still do, which is we do the work and hopefully the people who get something out of it support the work we're doing. So emptywheel.net is where they go. There's all kinds of ways to support you financially, right?
We're not Substack. We trust the honesty and support of our readers and listeners. So thanks to all.
Thanks to all, for sure. And please support Marcy's work if you can, because it's invaluable. I got to ask how you've made it through the last couple of weeks on Queen Death Watch over there. You're in Ireland, so not you're separate from the UK, right?
Oh, yeah. In fact, Ireland is one of the few places where you don't have to owe the Queen any kind of deference, because people in Ireland remember when the UK was still kind of interfering in Irish politics. So, yeah.
Okay, well, good to know. I just wanted to get that out of the way, because over here, my goodness, you can't turn on the TV without being taken to the funeral. It's like, okay. And now it's what, another 7 days of mourning or enough already. There's a lot of news over here that's been happening that hasn't gotten the coverage it should be getting. One of the reasons being because the Queen is still dead, I guess. So anyway,
she'll continue to be dead forever.
She will. She's still dead. Sorry. All right. So Marcy Wheeler, onto the business at hand. I guess the big news right now is that we have a special master who was appointed by this so-called judge. Where do we even begin? I guess the best way is to ask you what is top of the agenda for you right now and all the things you're looking at?
So today, I think after we record this, but maybe before you play it, there is going to be a hearing in Brooklyn where the special master is going to sit down with Trump and DOJ and say, here's how we're going to proceed. And it's going to be a big fight because Trump, you know, Trump doesn't want a special master. He wants to find some way to delay this case until after the election. And Deary already made a couple of requests that Trump is balking at, one of which is that Trump give him a list of all the documents that he claims to have declassified. So
And you explain that the reason behind that, the reason Trump doesn't want to do that is, say he lists three or five or whatever documents that he did ostensibly declassify, then he's admitting that he took like 100 documents that were classified, which is illegal. Yeah.
Which would be confession to guilt. Yeah. I mean, look, for Trump, Trump is trying to stay this entire thing. You know, he's claimed, oh, my God, they took my property. Aileen Cannon invented some things out of thin air to back that claim. She had no basis for that. And based on a claim that, oh, my gosh, they took my property, he is trying to both undermine any potential indictment against him and forestall it until after the election, at which point I'm sure Trump believes that Jim Jordan is going to be in a position to help him undermine any case against him as well. But I mean, understand, prosecutors to charge Trump with 18 U.S.C. 793, which is under the Espionage Act, though it's not spying unless we learn that he, say, sold these documents to the Saudis. To charge him under it, what they have to prove is that the documents remain what's called national defense information. So stuff that the government is trying to protect that could do grave damage to the United States if it gets out. And that Trump refused to give it back when DOJ came and asked for him. And when DOJ came and asked for this stuff in June, that should have been it. That should have been the slam dunk. Once they went in August and proved that there were still documents that Trump withheld in June, that's what they needed to make the case. And so what Trump is doing right now is he's trying to create some uncertainty about whether he believed in June these documents were still classified. These documents were not his property. It's all BS. It's not true, right? But that doesn't matter for Trump. It has never mattered for Trump. If he can make a claim that Judge Cannon in late November or early December or maybe early January somehow agrees, she doesn't even have to agree he's right. She just has to say, "Oh, it's a crazy claim, but since you're the former president, I'll judge that it's reasonable." That's where Trump wants to go. That's exactly how Trump believes he can beat this case. And so what he's trying to do is A, stall, B, avoid having the question of whether these were classified determined before Judge Cannon gets to undermine it, and C, invent some claim that, for example, documents that involve White House counsel, classified documents that involve White House counsel or classified documents that involve some lawyer from DOJ, possibly Bill Barr, if he can claim that those classified documents belong to him, which is what he's trying to do, then he can say, well, of course, I didn't have to turn them over because they belong to me. That's his defense. That is his defense, that he would go to DOJ in early January 2023, if this is not yet charged, and say, this is why you can't charge me under the Espionage Act, because this is what I'm going to tell the jury, and I'm going to convince at least two jurors that it's plausible. That's what this is all about.
Now, he expects this judge, and I use the term loosely, Judge Cannon, to do his bidding. And because he, number one, appointed her, unqualified as she was, for this lifetime of bench. And two, he went judge shopping, because that her court is still about 65, 70 miles away from Mar-a-Lago. And wouldn't the appropriate person have been the original magistrate who signed off on the search warrant?
That's one thing that Raymond Deary, the judge that's been appointed the special master, has said. He hasn't objected to Cannon's authority to appoint him special master, but he said, if you're going to make a Rule 41G motion, which is a motion that Trump should get his property back, don't you need to do that before the magistrate? Don't you need to do that before Bruce Reiner's case? That's one of the two things that Trump is already squawking about. I want to push back, though. Because I think people are misunderstanding Judge Cannon to our detriment, detriment of people who, first of all, she's not unqualified.
Okay.
She's young, she's inexperienced, but she's been both an appellate clerk and she's been a prosecutor for a number of years. She went to University of Michigan Law, University of Michigan PhD program created me. So right. She's not stupid.
Okay.
And I think a lot of people are assuming that her orders were stupid. And that not only, I think, sells her short, but also underestimates what she's doing. She's very smart. It's just that she's involved in accruing power for Trump, in a theory of power for Trump that is unsustainable under our mode of law. But that doesn't make her any different from Bill Barr.
Right.
And Bill Barr was obviously qualified and smart, just corrupt.
Right.
And I think that that's a better way of understanding Judge Cannon.
Okay.
Because I think doing anything but that, A, sells her short, and possibly does so in very gendered ways. I mean, she's as smart as Bill Barr, maybe smarter. Like, she was holding the hand of Trump's lawyers team because they kept screwing everything up, including the ones who are far more accomplished than her, and arranging it so that she would have some flimsy basis to claim authority, which is what she did. And she's as much on his legal team as they are. That doesn't make her stupid. It makes her corrupt. And I want to maintain that because so much of what Trump does is not about the law. It's about corruption. And this is what Judge Cannon is up to.
Right. And the thing is, what she's shown at first when he went to her, and it might have been on a different case, she said something like, why are you bringing this to me? This doesn't belong in this court. And sort of reprimanded him for it. But I think that was a somewhat related case and not the case about the special counsel. I could be wrong here. But then she...
And I also want to say that thus far, there's no proof that he succeeded in judge shopping. We'll see what Deary does with the Rule 41G, because it's Southern Florida. And the question is, where in Southern Florida you bring this case? So I even want to reserve on that.
Okay.
Maybe Trump got incredibly lucky. We're going to see, we may see today or tomorrow or this week, who on the 11th Circuit is going to rule on this Trump case. And we may be, and statistically, we shouldn't be surprised if there end up being three Trump-appointed judges, because he's appointed so many people on the 11th Circuit. But that would not be surprising either. This is the world that we live in after Trump had 4 years to stack the courts.
Right. I think
and
it's
so
six
that is the world we need to live with.
I think it's six of the 11 on the 11th circuit that he appointed. But that also doesn't necessarily say that they're going to rule in his favor. There are some judges who are corrupt. We can't get around that. But there are others who take, I guess, their appointments seriously and will rule based on the rule of law and not the partisan factors involved, right?
Yeah, and one thing that DOJ did very, I think, smartly, we'll see whether it works out for them, is they narrowed the issue. Right now, the only thing before the 11th Circuit is one, whether Trump has any chance of claiming that these classified documents are his and not lawfully seized under the warrant, and B, whether Judge Cannon can prevent them from whether those can be included in Judge Cannon's decision on the special master. And that is actually a very narrow question. There are about 10 Supreme Court precedents that say absolutely no way, both on matters of classification, on matters of executive privilege, on matters of separation of powers. And the question before the 11th Circuit, and if it gets there, the Supreme Court, is going to be, how much are you going to do for Donald Trump? Are you going to upend all three of those areas of law, classification, separation of powers, and executive privilege? I mean, they're related, but they're all going to be implicated if Trump gets his way. Or are you going to rule on what the precedents say you should rule on? And if DOJ gets, either from the 11th Circuit or SCOTUS, a ruling that says, yeah, right, classified documents are the matter for the executive, and so is criminal prosecutions matter for the executive, and we can't interfere into that without a real separation of problem a powers issue, then the special master may be somewhat of a sidelight. It will take the things that Trump needs most off the table.
Right. And there's one other consideration to think about as well, which is the fact that, you know, Deary was one of Trump's picks. Each side gave two choices. The Justice Department accepted Deary, saying he's fully qualified and capable and unimpeachable on these issues. Trump is already pushing back on what he wants. He said he took the original deadline for these documents to be reviewed of November 30th and said, no, we need them by, I think, October 7th. And so saying, basically, you're not going to use me to delay this, as, you know, it appears to be what you want. So there are reasons to be optimistic that this will move quickly.
So a couple of things. One is, Raymond Deary is the fourth person to approve a FISA warrant against Carter Page. And Axios, at least, reported that led Trump to believe that he would be suspicious of FBI in this matter. Whether or not that's true, I think Deary offered kind of a heads you win, tails DOJ loses, because if Deary is replaced, then Trump will be able to say, as you know, what he said for 4 years, you know, oh, Deary was just part of Russiagate. Deary was part of the hoax against me in Russia. And that's what's going to happen. Now, I pointed out sometime in the last however long, it's all a haze for me at this point. Sure. But in her order appointing Deary, Cannon took, there are parts of it that are just boilerplate. Right. So if you look at it, anything that deviates from the boilerplate should grab your attention. And one of the areas where she deviated from the boilerplate is, the boilerplate says, and I'm paraphrasing here, but the boilerplate says, if things are not moving along, the judge can replace the special master.
Right.
And what Cannon did is she took that language, if things are not moving along, out, and she said the judge can replace the special master. So she has basically expanded the basis on which she could replace Deary to whatever she wants, which is what she did in taking this case in the first place. So one should assume there's a decent chance that Deary will be replaced either now or after the election. I wrote a piece right before I came on where, if you think about Deary as similar to Robert Mueller, that he serves a purpose until such time as you're in a political position to do far more outrageous things. And that's what I suspect Deary is going to quickly become in this process, is like get through the election and then fire him and do something more outrageous, unless the 11th Circuit and SCOTUS take that off the table. And then after you fire him, say, oh, my gosh, he's part of the Russia hoax. That's honestly where I think it's going to go. That's what I think Cannon envisions as one possibility down the road. But she built into this process the ability to fire Deary. Yes, the fact that Deary from the start said, here's the deadlines are actually not unreasonable. Mm-hmm. They are, in DOJ's case, they said, we think you should be able to review 500 documents a day if we're going to get through these 11,000 and fight about it by November 30th. Then really you should be done. And I did the math. I think DOJ's deadline would put it October 15th. So actually after Deary's. But what both Erie and DOJ are doing is saying, you're going to come up with all these determinations by mid-October sometime, and then we're going to fight about it for another 6 weeks. And then after we fight about it for another 6 weeks, then we're going to hand it off to Cannon. And to allow for all those fights to happen by November 30th, we actually have to start fighting by mid-October.
Wow.
And that's reasonable. It's just that Trump's trying to change the order of things. It's just as important. I pointed out that Trump, Cannon created a harm and then intervened to fix the harm.
Okay.
This hasn't gotten enough attention. She said, look, you've got these potentially privileged documents and Trump doesn't know the basis for privilege. And because you have them, I have to interfere. And she did that after prohibiting DOJ from sharing those documents with Trump. Like back on August 30th, DOJ said, hey, we've got all of these potentially privileged documents all packaged up. Can we please give them to Trump? And she said, no, I want to deal with this holistically. And then in every order she's issued, she has said, well, gosh, look at what you did with the potentially privileged documents. That's a harm. I have to intervene to fix it. So Judge Cannon, create a harm, intervene, use that harm that you created to intervene to fix it. And back on Friday, after Deary was appointed, DOJ said to Trump, finally, after, and so this was 17 days after they had first asked Cannon to hand these documents over, they said, here, Trump, here are your potentially privileged documents. Mm-hmm. Now, if you are DOJ and you believe that Trump should be able to review 500 documents a day, then Trump should have been able to review those 64 documents over the course of the weekend and should come in today and say, you know what? You were right. Those potentially privileged documents really aren't privileged. Here, you can have them back. And instead, Trump, one of the first things he did was say, here's the schedule I want. I want all of the classified documents this week. And then next week, I'll tell you which of these potentially privileged documents are potentially privileged. And, you know, it's not inconsistent with the way I think Cannon arranged this, the way in which Cannon has arranged this to, again, create a harm and intervene to fix it. Mm-hmm. But it is ridiculous that Trump says he couldn't review 64 documents over the course of the weekend. And that is where Trump has started this whole contest from.
Because he's not looking at the rule of law. He's looking to delay. I mean, this is his strategy, obviously. And in some sense, it's working.
He's looking to delay. He's looking to create conflict. And then out of that conflict, he's looking to undermine rule of law and to create a narrative that he's being victimized by the national security state. It's the same thing he did with the Russian investigation. Mm-hmm. And it's the same play. I mean, again, a post that I did right before we came on, 4 years ago, almost this day, is when Paul Manafort entered into a quasi plea deal with Mueller.
Wow.
And it was a fake. I mean, all he was doing was buying time to get past the election so that Trump could fire Jeff Sessions, hire Bill Barr. And the fact that he lied for the ensuing 2 months ended up not mattering, because once Bill Barr came in, Barr and Trump just simply erased every single bit of the Russian investigation. And you know, eventually Manafort was pardoned and got out of jail and even had his forfeiture reversed in the pardon. And so that is what Trump wants to do again, the same thing he did with the Russian investigation. And the quicker we get to the point where we recognize that this is an effort to create conflict, to discredit rule of law, to really dismantle rule of law, that's what it's about. So we shouldn't engage Trump's legal arguments as if they're in good faith, because they're ridiculous. They're not in good faith.
Right. And that's apparent. Yet it seems that the media, afraid of being accused of favoring one side over the other, it puts out these false equivalencies and treats this like it's legit. And that, I think, is one of the dangers of what we're looking at, because propaganda.
Yeah, I mean, I also have to say, I mean, there are probably only a handful of other really qualified journalists to cover this. Charlie Savage at the New York Times is one. Josh Gerstein at Politico is another. And they've covered a bunch of national security cases and know this law really well. There are other DOJ reporters. And even a bunch of former prosecutors, I can't tell you the number of people who contacted me and said, thank God you're doing your reporting, because a lot of the former prosecutors who have 20 years experience don't know this national security stuff as well as you do. And it's true. I mean, because they're thinking of this in terms of a normal criminal case, and a lot of these legal issues don't work that way. But even your normal DOJB reporter is going to struggle with some of the concepts. And then there's a whole, I mean, every time that you have an investigation do high profile person, at least half of the journalists who end up covering it are not DOJ reporters, they're political reporters. Mm-hmm. And so, right, that's where you get this both sides thing. Oh, Trump says this and here's this. And it's also, this is why, Nicole, a million years ago, I first started reporting, is because in the Judy Miller case, in the Scooter Libby case, when defense lawyers are the only ones talking to the press and you don't have people reading the court filings, what you have is this real misrepresentation of what goes on. And that continues to be true of journalism today. And it's especially true here with Trump, because, you know, you've got what, like five people embedded at Mar-a-Lago as his personal scribes. So that's what is causing the unfortunate reporting on this. All I can do is keep reporting and try and, you know, call out when people are making ridiculous claims, and that's all I can do.
And you do it beautifully, and we so appreciate it. But a few things that we must keep in mind. One is he's controlling the narrative to be what he wants. This is a man who twice in the last few days has said, either blatantly out, you know, with no caveats, if I'm indicted, there's going to be violence. My people are going to take to the streets. And it seems to me that the cover he's being given is almost akin to, and you know what, I'm not even going to go there. I was going to say the way that the world is afraid to take on Vladimir Putin because he's threatening nukes. It's the same thing. Trump is threatening a massive, I don't know, a war, civil war, if he is held to the law. And I think everyone should be worried about.
Well, and I mean, look at coverage from the weekend, right? So Trump had this rally in Ohio, couldn't fill the stadium.
Right.
Couldn't fill it. There were big empty parts of the stadium. And it's like all you have to do to neutralize Trump's power is show that he can't fill a stadium.
Pull out.
That's all you need to do. Instead of that, people focused on some subset of his followers. And for all we know, they were actors, because Trump has a history of bringing actors, but some subset who like lifted their fingers, and it's like this was his QAnon moment. He is adopting QAnon narratives. Yep. I mean, and that is dangerous. And rather than undermine the power of that QAnon narrative or point out that most of the general admission people weren't doing that, or that there were huge empty parts of the stadium, everyone's like, oh, here's what Trump is doing. And meanwhile, and I recommend anybody who missed this yesterday or over the weekend to go check it out. Merrick Garland gave a speech at Ellis Island after swearing in a bunch of new citizens. And it was a really powerful speech. It was about rule of law. It was about fragile rule of law is. He ended the speech by thanking all of these citizens. It was, I mean, it's beautiful. And he was holding back tears when he talked about his ancestors who survived the Holocaust because of what used to be rule of law here in the United States. And, you know, there are so many ways you report those two events. And one way you report those two events is to focus on the guy who's actually still in power and just ignore Trump entirely. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Another way is, you know, just to report on the fact that the attorney general is sitting here saying we may lose rule of law imminently, which seems like should lead all of the news.
Yes.
And instead, Trump's staged rally. Yeah, and the queen.
And the queen.
And one of the things that's interesting about all of this as well, so Trump took all of the press from the weekend with that staged rally, and none of it was talking about how empty the stadium was. Or the fact that none of the people there could actually chant Ohio chants. Like, these were not Ohioans. They were probably Pennsylvanians and Indianans and Michigans and Michiganians and Wisconsin, you know. Like,
interesting.
It doesn't, it was right across the border from Pennsylvania, in Ryan's home district. So it was an attempt to go straight after Ryan.
Nice.
But as such, it's a commute distance, and actually people do commute from Western Pennsylvania to Youngstown, to the extent there are still jobs in Youngstown, which there really aren't. But the other thing that's happening is, you know, the Republican Party was like, oh, please let us get to the election without Trump becoming the center of attention again. You know, and they were like, let's just get to the election, claim Joe Biden has created inflation. And frankly, even if Trump hadn't fought and got a special master, then DOJ probably would have just, you know, hunkered down and put together this Espionage Act indictment against the president while we voted. And instead, because of the special master fight, Trump's going to be in the press every day. Right. So that, you know, and Trump's popularity is below what it's ever been. Even, you know, I think Republicans are like, please, can we move on? Can we move on to Ron DeSantis, who's at least a competent fascist, right? Like, and DeSantis is now pulling these stunts by kidnapping migrants and sending them to Martha's Vineyard, you know? So whatever else it's doing is it's turning the election, the pre-election, especially the Republican side of it, into just another circus. And I can't tell you how it's going to affect the outcome of the election, but it will affect the outcome of the election. Effectively, you know, it makes Trump the center of the Republican Party again, and a lot of Republicans would prefer him not to be. And it gives DOJ not just the right, but the necessity to continue talking about this case against Trump. If it becomes clear how grave the gravity of Trump's crime, then that could really kind of snowball things right in time for the election. But, you know, I don't claim to know what's going to happen in the next 6 weeks.
Not a crystal ball on the shelf behind you. Marcy Wheeler is with us. She writes brilliantly about all that's going on at emptywheel.net. You should be reading it all the time, in case you're not. So concurrently, while the prosecution and the investigations into Trump is now, you know, center stage, and for months we were wondering if the Justice Department was even going there. You've been telling us, yes, they are. Be patient. We've got the January 6th committee, which has to wind down before the end of the year. We're hearing there will be another public hearing, possibly the end of this month, maybe next week, it's looking like. And we've got the special master and all this going on. Meanwhile, at the same time, the prosecutions of the January 6th insurrectionists are still happening. You got the spin machine in full swing. Tucker Carlson again making news by calling January 6th a, quote, nonviolent election justice protest, which, okay. So there are, though, these court cases coming up. The Oath Keepers are now coming up for a trial. What is happening in these prosecutions that we need to know about?
Yeah, and in fact, Doug Jensen, the guy wearing a QAnon t-shirt who chased Officer Goodman up the stairs, mm-hmm. He's in jury selection as we speak. And Tom Barrack, so Trump's big donor, who was his inauguration chair, also jury selection as we speak in Brooklyn. So those cases are, you know, happening as we speak. And the Oath Keepers, I'm going to forget the day that it starts, but they're in the last weeks of pretrial discussions. And, you know, that's going to be a huge deal regardless. The judge in that case, Amit Mehta, is a great judge. He's a former defense attorney, but he's already like forestalled some attempts to turn it into a circus. But understand that as the first sedition trial, throughout history, it is always the case that right-wing white terrorists turn their trials into claims of martyrdom. Mm-hmm. And there's one set of attorneys already who were preparing to do that for Kelly Meggs from Florida. This new lawyer just kind of swooped in and said he's representing Stuart Rhodes, the head of the Oath Keepers. And his lawyers were like, WTF. But that lawyer, it's clear, wants to do some of the same. And so you will see an interesting effort to turn the Oath Keepers into martyrs with that trial. And frankly, that's what's going to take up the last weeks before the election. So the degree to which the press reports clearly that these people were trying to overthrow the election and that these people are Trump's people, That's another thing that's going to determine the election. But yeah, that is definitely coming up. I mean, and we will, from here on out, we're going to continue to see pretty high level trials in January 6th until Jim Jordan shuts down all of DOJ, if he does, because they're all teed up.
So Marcy Wheeler, the Republicans are still counting on them taking back control of at least the House of Representatives in the November 8th election, which means come January, whenever the next session of Congress convenes at the beginning of January, all these investigations are done. So is there any coordination? There's a January 6th committee, which again says they're going to issue a first an interim report and then a final report sometime before the end of the year. But Justice Department, they continue their investigations. That doesn't end because the Justice Department is still intact at least until the 2024 election is done, right?
Well, the other thing that happened is that in the days before DOJ would the 60-day deadline for overt acts, they issued a whole bunch of subpoenas. Steve Bannon falsely claimed that 35 people had been raided or 45 people had been raided. I mean, Steve Bannon doing what Steve Bannon does, which is lie. But nevertheless, what they did is they asked for information from people, and they're going to start getting that information this week, pertaining not just to the fake electors plot, but to things like the funding of January 6th, to the setup, the Kramers, Amy and I forget the other one, but the two women who set up the rally, they're being asked about their organization. And so one of the things that I think is the case, I mean, for example, the DOJ is investigating Trump's PAC and the way in which that money got spent. And as always, people are like, well, DOJ is just following what the January 6th committee did. And that may be true. But we know that Merrick Garland said DOJ was following the money trail on January 5th, mm-hmm. well before the January 6th committee actually started. And this is following the money. Following the money is the kind of thing where you can do a great deal of work before it goes overt. And so it's unclear how much DOJ is going to get done between now and the election, but it is not outside the realm of possibility that you're going to start seeing indictments after the election, after they've had these 2 months to work on all of this stuff. But it does seem clear that all of these interrelated strands that DOJ laid the base for, they're pulling all of them at once at this point. This is what DOJ, you know, they're just pulling all of these things together and rolling it up into a ball, and we'll see what comes out after the election. But that is going on as we speak.
Is there any indication that Ginni Thomas and her involvement is being looked at? The wife of Clarence Thomas.
DOJ is not going to overtly go after Ginni Thomas until such time as they have a cooperator against her. Mm. Ginni Thomas, you know, they're not. And I think that that's probably wise. I may not like that. That does put her above the law in a way that other people aren't. But if, for example, they flipped John Eastman and John Eastman said, yeah, Ginni told me to do it all. I mean, that's hypothetical. I'm not saying we know that to be true. But if that happened, then when DOJ went after Ginni Thomas, you would have John Eastman saying, we have to go after Ginni Thomas because she was the mastermind. And I think that's an unfortunate aspect of investigating these really powerful people. But it is, like, I think some of what DOJ is doing with the espionage investigation into Trump, that's true as well. I mean, I think that they are giving more deference to the special master than they would in other cases. But I think it's not necessarily a bad thing that they allow Raymond Deary to take a good look at what they're doing and say, you know what, this is all according to the book. They're like, this all looks like it should look. And, you know, they're also right about the grave national security implications of it. And so I think that's one of the things that's probably going on as we speak.
Good, as it should, because look, Deary, the special master, was Trump's pick. So it should be after the fact, he really can't complain. This is the guy he picked, and so go with it. There's another question, and you have a piece up at emptywheel.net, Marcy, that from a couple of days ago on the belated education of John Durham. Now, are we done with John Durham yet? I mean, John Durham was the guy, the Trump investigation into the oranges of the Russia probe, right? So what's happening with John Durham?
It's another trial that's going to take place in the weeks before the election. Igor Danchenko, who is the primary subsource for Christopher Steele for the dossier, goes on trial on October 11th in Virginia. And that case is just as weak as Michael Sussman's case, the one that ended up in acquittal and a very quick acquittal. And there are still some hurdles that DOJ, that Durham has to get by to even get to trial, because Judge Trengai, Anthony Trengai in that case, still hasn't made a final what's called CIPA, Classified Information Procedures Act. He still hasn't decided how much classified information Igor Danchenko can have to use at trial, and whether Durham can get that declassified, whether DOJ is willing to declassify that so that Danchenko can use it at trial. That decision is not going to happen until after September 29th. We're on September 29th. And in recent days, we've learned that Igor Danchenko was a CIA source, a paid CIA source from 2017 until 2020. That, as I will show in an upcoming post, that actually makes a lot of sense, and Republicans should not balk at that, but of course they balk at everything. We also discovered that, based on information Danchenko gave in part, one of the key sources that Durham will use against Danchenko was also under investigation. So both the key sources against Danchenko were both investigated, or at least considered for investigation, by DOJ, the other one being Sergey Milian. Durham also admitted that basically he's been yanked around by Sergey Milian for a year, claiming that maybe he could get Sergey Milian to testify against Danchenko, which I wrote right after the indictment. I'm like, you're nuts to try this, John Durham. And sure enough, John Durham has now confessed that he has no witness there.
Wow.
So it's a mess. It is crazy. And the question, you know, whether or not win or lose or even go to trial, I think going forward, is what then happens to a Durham report if he has one and possibly two acquittals that not only undermine the cases he made against the people he charged, but also suggest that the larger conspiracy theories that he has spun and Trump and everyone else has latched onto have no basis in fact. And I don't know what's going to happen, but that's why people should keep an eye on the Danchenko trial as well.
Most definitely. And we can at emptywheel.net, thanks to you. So all the more reason. So now I got to ask one other thing, because my TV doesn't physically go on Fox. I can't do it because there's a lot of propaganda being put out by that channel, but they insist that there's a real story there that the rest of the media is ignoring, and that's Hunter Biden's laptop. And now we have Ashley Biden's diary, and James O'Keefe from the ridiculously Orwellian named Project Veritas is involved here because apparently one of his people stole it. Is there any there? What should we know about Hunter Biden's laptop and Ashley Biden's diary, if anything?
What you should know about Ashley Biden's diary is she wrote this diary when she was in recovery. And so no one should take what somebody writes in recovery as true. And that is the basis that Republicans use to claim that it was newsworthy. A woman who stayed in the room that Ashley Biden stayed in when she was in recovery stole the diary.
Oh, my God.
Has since admitted to trafficking in stolen goods with another guy. And the other guy is cooperating, which suggests that James O'Keefe may be charged, or at least his compatriots may be charged with basically soliciting the theft, not of the diary itself, but of some other belongings from Ashley Biden. Because what they did is they said, we need you to prove this is Ashley Biden's diary. Go get more stuff.
Oh, God.
And they did. They went to the same room that she had stayed at and had been told she could store stuff at, and took more of it and gave it to Project Veritas. And that stuff went from Florida to New York and back to Florida. And so that is the basis for the investigation against O'Keefe. And I don't know how, you know, probably DOJ will consider that something that they can't charge until after the election. But that is, they've got a cooperating witness now against the Project Veritas people. the Hunter Biden stuff, I think by all reports, the U.S. attorney in Delaware was allowed to stay on so that there would be no question about anybody in Biden's camp directing that investigation. And there's just not as much there as people want there to be. I mean, yeah, Biden traded on his father's position to get influence and jobs, but every single Republican does that. That's right. Certainly, you know, Jared Kushner did that from inside the White House.
That's
so did
right.
Ivanka.
Yep.
And this is all they've got, but they've also, you know, they spent a lot of effort getting some of this dirt from Russia in the couple years before the election. And this is, I mean, this is really an attempt to use blackmail that was dealt to Republicans to get Biden not to run.
Wow.
This is how people need to start talking about this. This is, you know, that the whole Hunter Biden thing came, we know, with the assistance of Russian assets who were talking of Rudy Giuliani. Rudy Giuliani was running all over Ukraine trying to get this stuff. Mm-hmm. And GRU hacked Burisma and may well have altered emails that everyone thinks came directly from Biden. And, you know, we need to start calling it what it is. It's like, this is using Russian hacked information, Russian disinformation, Russian package, Russian blackmail to try and weaken Joe Biden. And the Republicans, 201, are all not only happy, they're all a part of that. And at some point, you know, there needs to be, people need to start calling that out. At some point, like, and I think, again, you talked about reporters earlier. It's like, I think there's a hesitation. Like, we just ignore Fox and pretend it's not
right.
going on.
Yeah.
But I mean, one of the explanations for how Judge Cannon, who's very smart, got to be the way she is if she watches Fox News, she may legitimately believe that Trump was badly done by the Russian investigation, not because it's true, but because the bubble in which she lives has told her that it's true. And right. she doesn't get outside of the bubble enough to challenge that. And I think that that's, you know, that is the reality they're creating with Hunter Biden's laptop. It's nonsense. But these people aren't interested in truth or facts. They're interested in a narrative.
Right. And the more they hammer it, the more the legitimate media, I don't know what to call them, the rest of the media landscape says, oh, I guess we do need to talk about this. Well, maybe not. But
well, let's go back to Durham, because I think okay. that was really interesting. When he charged Danchenko last November, a bunch of outlets, and I remember CNN did this, Washington Post did this, a bunch of outlets said, oh my gosh, what we said about the dossier was true. We're going to finally come clean about the dossier, about Sergey Milyen. And at the time I was like, whoa, look, you guys are making the same mistakes with this Danchenko indictment that you made with the dossier, because you're not looking at it to see whether it's reliable. And I pointed out at the time, for example, like, you can look at what Durham says was said in certain interviews, and you can look at the actual transcript and prove that he's not even cutting pasting. Like, he's not even quoting accurately from documents that are available from you. And that should lead you as a journalist to say, you know, maybe there's some truth to what Durham is saying, but he has proven, like, the ways in which I can test his reliability don't hold up. And instead, last November, all of these outlets were like, oh, we've got to rethink the dossier. We've got to rethink the P-tape. We've got to rethink Sergey Milyen. And now, after the Sussman verdict, people are like, well, maybe something's going on with Danchenko. We don't really know. And they, as you said, are, I think, loath to look very closely and say, you know, there are real problems with this. But we, you know, these outlets should make corrections of what yeah. they've said in the past. And just as an example, the New York Times had a story recently about Durham's grand jury expiring. And in it, you know, paragraph 8, I think it was, they said Sussman was acquitted, which, you know, should be paragraph 1, like, oh my God, embarrassing failure on the part of Durham. But then on paragraph 28, and it was literally 20 paragraphs later, New York Times said, Durham alleged that Hillary Clinton was in deep with the dossier and all of this was coordinated, blah, 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 blah. And it's like, if you say in paragraph 8 that argument that you put in paragraph 28 ended up in an acquittal, then you have to you know, when you talk about that narrative, you have to say it was proven to be false.
Right.
And New York Times didn't do that. New York Times, you know, split them 20 paragraphs apart and hasn't like said Durham told a false tale. And the acquittal, the jury has decided that it was a false tale. And therefore, we can now say the claim that Hillary Clinton was coordinating the Alpha Bank story is false. It's false. Durham couldn't prove it. He tried, failed. And we're not yet there with the press. And that's unfortunate because that means that Durham is still having the effect, even on the, you know, in the mainstream press, not Fox, that he was hired to have. It doesn't matter whether it's true. It matters whether the false tales that he tells are accepted uncritically, and too much of that is still going on.
Right. So again, Durham was put in place to investigate the origins of the Russia investigation. So that fizzled on them. They did investigate Hillary Clinton and her emails. And what was the final outcome there? Was she ever charged? Was it ever determined that she had any classified emails on her personal computer and the server in her basement? Was there anything found there that, because they're still harping on it years later?
Right. I mean, the outcome of Hillary's investigation is that there wasn't the requisite intent that she was deliberately trying to keep classified information. None of the examples where there was classified information marked in the emails ended up holding up. There were claims that stuff that was sent to her that she sent, topics that she discussed was classified. And just to compare to Trump, right? Like, so Trump, altogether, there's, I'm going to forget the number, basically 300 emails that he, 300 documents that are marked as classified that he stole. And some of them marked so high that the FBI needed to get extra clearances to get them. By comparison, there were only three documents ever that were claimed to be marked as classified, and they were marked confidential, right?
Top secret, but confidential.
Right. So first of all, you've got a vast disparity in the seriousness of the classified information at issue. But the other thing that's going on is just in August alone, there were another 11,000 government documents taken. And some of those things are going to be notes involving Trump. And just imagine, for example, if Trump is taking notes from a phone call with Vladimir Putin, those notes, like Hillary Clinton's emails or emails to Hillary Clinton, may discuss topics that are highly sensitive, like, say, the withdrawal from Syria. Mm-hmm. Secret. That's secret. But that would not have a secret marker on it because they're just Trump's notes.
Right.
And DOJ, as far as we know, and the IC, as far as we know, has not even begun to assess the classification, whether the other unmarked documents seized from Trump or turned over by Trump included classified information. So when people say, oh, there was 140 classified blah, blah, blah in Hillary Clinton's server, DOJ, the IC, as far as we know, hasn't even begun to see how much of the, you know, say 30,000 conservatively documents between the multiple boxes turned over. They haven't even begun to assess whether some of the other things Trump had sitting in his basement closet were also classified. All they've done is said there are 300 documents that were marked as classified. Right. There are 90 files that included very sensitive information that are empty. And that's the baseline that they're starting from. So they're well beyond any comparison. The other thing is that, you know, Trump received a subpoena and the subpoena said, give us all the documents that are marked as classified.
Right.
It didn't say, give us all the documents that you deem to be classified. It said, give us all the documents that are marked as classified. And that should have turned over the 103 documents that were seized in August. There's no comparison. There's no similar moment with Hillary where she's asked to turn something over and she completely defies a subpoena. And you know, that's one of the many, many reasons why there's not a comparison.
There you go. We could keep going, but that, you said it all. I mean, people need to open their eyes and see what's going on. The false equivalency and the disparities that exist are just right there for anybody who cares to look, and at emptywheel.net. Marcy Wheeler, is there anything that I didn't hit on that we should be talking about?
No, I will say one thing, though, that keep in mind that not just the January 6th investigation into Trump, but the January 6th investigation into the perpetrators goes on. And the reason I call attention to that is because the guy who went nuts and tried to breach the FBI office when Trump was first seized, that guy was at January 6th. Mm. That guy is the trespasser that everyone says, oh, we don't have to worry about those trespassers. There's another guy who was arrested as a trespasser for January 6th who has ties to the Proud Boys, was a cleared defense contractor with NRO, so he works on satellite stuff, who was a Naval Reserve petty officer doing weekend Naval Reserve activities at Andrews Air Force Base. Wow. At Andrews Air Force Base, right? So yeah. He was going armed to Andrews Air Force Base as a Navy Reserve guy. And he was arrested for trespassing during the summer and subsequently had some unregistered weapons charged against him in Virginia.
Lovely.
And the reason I raise that, and this kind of brings everything full circle, is when you talk about Trump sowing violence, mm-hmm. the people, even just the people who were at January 6th that haven't been charged yet, and I say conservatively the number of people that FBI must know about that they haven't charged yet is probably 5,000 people. Those people were radicalized there, and they're all out there. They're all out there listening to Trump call for revolution.
Yep.
And we continue to discover that these are heavily armed people. Many of them have ties to national security or the military or the cops or what have you. And they're all still out there. And so like, I know everyone's really impatient with DOJ. You need to charge Trump tomorrow, but DOJ is playing a very delicate balance of trying to neutralize the threat of those people who are all armed with Trump calling for them to
rise up,
to rise up. And so, you know, it's going to be a crazy couple of months, and talk to you soon.
Yeah, no kidding. As we get closer and closer to November 8th, I expect the temperature to keep rising in more ways than one.
Yeah.
Marcy Wheeler, you are the best. I can't thank you enough. Again, emptywheel.net. Go there, read, and contribute, because Marcy's work is so valuable. So important. Thank you again. Have a wonderful day. And yes, we will talk again soon. Always. Marcy Wheeler. What a, you know, look, I sing her praises all the time, and it sounds a bit much, but it's real. She keeps it all straight. I don't get it. At least she admits, you know, she writes shit down, and that's a good thing. Those of you who are new to the program, welcome. I know every time Marcy comes on, we get a lot of interest, and for good reason, because there's nobody doing the work that she's doing, and I so appreciate it. Tomorrow on the show, as of now, we're just going to talk about what's going on. We'll talk about what happened today with the hearing, or the first meeting of all the interested parties with the special master. Maybe we'll get into what a special master would do in another kind of world. I don't know. Perhaps. Then Thursday, of course, Howie Klein is here, the man behind Down with Tyranny and the Blue America Pack is with us every Thursday, has been for more than a decade now. And then on Friday, I have a really special show planned for you. Dar Williams is an amazing singer-songwriter who I first met, I hate to say it, 32 years ago, back in 1995 was the first time I interviewed her. And I haven't spoken to her in over 25 years. She has a new book out called How to Write a Song, a Meaningful Song. I'm screwing up the title of the book. I promise you I'll get it right on Friday. Anyway, we taped it today. First, I taped Marcy in the morning, and then I taped with Dar Williams at noon. So I'm a bit exhausted now, but it's a good tired, you know? I think you're going to love this. And so I'll have a special treat for you on Friday after the interview with Dar, and she does perform her song for us. And it's a wide-reaching interview, as they say. I promise you'll enjoy it. Even if you're not familiar with her, you should be. And then I'll go back and play some of the early stuff, like this one, I'll tell you, in a career that's lasted over 40 years, yeah, I'm old, one of the high points of that career was Dar Williams and Joan Baez joining me for a remote broadcast, a morning show in Los Angeles from a Starbucks. I used to do this with different artists, and they brought the house down. It was brilliant. So I'll share some of that, some treats. It's a good way to go into the weekend. But tomorrow we'll hit on more news, everything that happened today. Those of you who are new to the program, I hope you come back. We do this every weekday afternoon, 5 Eastern, 2 Pacific, and then the show's available as a podcast. There's no paywall, but I do depend on your support to keep us going. All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. Mwah! I'll see you tomorrow. And what I do when the show officially ends, we're now, I think, done at the Progressive Voices Network. They leave us at 6 o'clock. Then I leave you with the news. So there's a lot that's missing from today just because I had such a busy morning. Thoughts, and I hate the term, prayers, and hopefully a lot of relief coming for the people in Puerto Rico who 5 years ago today, they were hit by Hurricane Maria. And here we are again, devastated, this time by Category 1 storm. Power's out, water's out through much of the island. It's just a disaster. And there's yet another named storm that was just named in the last hour. Yeah, welcome to hurricane season. And you wonder why I want to leave Florida? Well, Rick Scott, Ron DeSantis, Marco Rubio, those are enough reasons. But then there are the hurricanes too. All right. Until tomorrow, everybody, thank you for listening. I'll leave you with the news. Bye.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
The newly appointed special master charged with determining what's in that tranche of documents seized by the FBI when they executed a search warrant on Mar-a-Lago last month will meet with lawyers from the former guy's team and the Department of Justice prosecutors for the first time Tuesday in Brooklyn, in case you were wondering. Both parties on Monday filed separate proposals for what would be discussed during today's hearing. Just a programming note, that independent journalist Marcy Wheeler of EmptyWheel.net is my special guest on the Tuesday edition of the Nicole Sandler
Show. You just
heard
that.
It's heard on Progressive Voices at 5 Eastern, 2 Pacific, and will be available after on demand at NicoleSandler.com. It's well worth the listen for all the details that you're not getting from the mainstream corporate media. Election Day is just 7 weeks away. With the possibility that the control of the House could go back to Republicans, there's lots to get done before the end of the year. Representatives Liz Cheney and Zoe Lofgren are introducing legislation that would prevent future attempts to overturn elections. Called the Presidential Election Reform Act, it centers on overhauling the Electoral Count Act, an archaic law that governs the counting of votes from the Electoral College. A committee markup is slated for today, and the full House is expected to vote on it as soon as Wednesday, when it's expected to pass with the support of Democrats and at least a few Republicans. Now, the Senate released its own version in June, but the earliest it would be brought up there for a vote is after the midterm elections during the lame duck session. The Democrats, now in control, want to put Republicans on the record before the elections. That's why the urgency in the House. The current law allows for one House member and one senator to raise an objection to a state's results during a joint session of Congress. The Senate bill would increase that threshold to one-fifth of each chamber, while the House version makes it even more difficult, requiring one-third of each body to approve debate. Both the House and Senate bills set deadlines for governors to send Congress their state's electoral votes. If the governor refuses or sends the wrong ones, the candidate can file suit. The House bill says that if a governor doesn't submit an accurate number of electors by a certain date, then candidates can obtain a federal court order compelling the governor to immediately act. If the governor again refuses, the House bill says the court can then appoint another state official to send the slate of electors to Congress. I thought this was supposed to simplify everything. Anyway, the House measure is more specific in its redefinition of the Electoral Count Act's failed elections provision, while both bills clarify that a state's election can only be extended in the case of a, quote, genuine catastrophic event that can prove enough ballots could not be cast. The House bill specifies that a catastrophic event is defined as a natural disaster and must get the approval of a federal judge. Complicated much? Here's a suggestion. Count all the votes. The candidate who gets the most votes wins. Sounds like democracy to me. Isn't that the point? There's other legislation that has to pass, like the continuing resolution, which will keep the government running. Chuck Schumer is still insisting, though, that he'll attach to that continuing resolution Joe Manchin's side deal that would change the permitting process for energy projects. That's something that split the Democrats, with progressives vehemently opposed to the measure. And Republicans are saying they can't support anything without first seeing the details. And then Republican Senator John Cornyn said that there's bad blood with Manchin over his support for the Democrats' climate change and health care bill, known as the Inflation Reduction Act. He said, quote, "There's not a lot of sympathy on our side to provide Senator Manchin a reward for his flip-flop on the reconciliation bill." So there's all of that. Meanwhile, fallout from the stunt pulled by the Florida governor last week when he took a group of around 50 Venezuelans seeking asylum from San Antonio, Texas, to Martha's Vineyard is growing. Now, a sheriff in Texas announced that he's launched a criminal investigation into DeSantis's actions. The sheriff, Javier Salazar of Bexar County, Texas, an elected Democrat, by the way, said that the migrants were, quote, "in the country legally, and somebody came from out of state, preyed upon these people, lured them with promises of a better life, then, quote, unceremoniously stranded them for nothing more than political posturing," end quote. Immigrants' right groups and Democrats have made similar complaints. DeSantis said that the migrants signed a waiver and left willingly. Sure, they did. The United Nations General Assembly is back in New York this week after 3 years of virtual meetings due to the pandemic. A total of 193 UN member countries will deliberate in person about the challenges the planet's now facing. As expected, the invasion of Ukraine by Russia is casting a shadow over the entire thing. As for Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, he will be the only world leader to speak by video. Understandable, as Russia has been waging war on his country since February. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com. And please click on that donate button.